Tonight we are talking about the four beasts of the book of Ezekiel and of the Revelation. And the diagram that I've sketched is essential to see the relations between these four creatures. So I'll put it down. I might not leave it on too long. So when I switch on, you'll have a look at it, and we will discuss it. Then I might switch off, and then you can see if you can remember the diagram. The reference is to four beasts before the throne of God. And the four beasts include, funnily enough, man. And we're going to see why this is so. So I'll put on the diagram now. Is that visible? It's darker down here than it does up there, actually. And you'll see here three circles. They're drawn with a pair of compasses. And they lace together, and in the top one we have an eagle, and here we've got a lion, and then we've got an ox, and in the middle we have a man. Now these correspond with the four fixed signs of the zodiac. The eagle is Scorpio, transcendent, turned into Aquila, the eagle. We'll see why in a moment. When the scorpion becomes an eagle, and that is an air sign transcendent in a water sign. We'll see why. Water means feeling, and air means intellection. How the Scorpio, a water sign, fits becomes an eagle, a creature of the air, we see when we remember that we refine our ideas by refining our feelings. We refine the water, we heat it, and it becomes an air, a gas. The lion is a fire sign and represents primaries of will and energy. And the ox here is an earth sign and represents body, physicality. We're going to consider very carefully the relation between these three beings and how their interlocking circles produce a figure which is represented here with the head or face of a man, out of whose mouth goes the sword. You notice the curls on his forehead there are 666. That's because in the book of Revelation it is stated the number of a man and of a beast is 666. We have discussed this on other occasions. We'll rediscuss it tonight rather more in detail. Now the eagle flies high, and it goes up and lives in an eyrie in the mountains. And the eyrie is referring to the eye. The eagle can see from a great height the pattern of earth events. So the eagle corresponds with the transcendent intellectual faculty. It represents Sophia, wisdom. It represents Logos, cosmic logic. It represents the noumenal world, the world of Plato's ideas. It represents the eidetic field. It transcends ordinary mental activities. The lion represents the energy, the courage, the kingship of the being. And the ox represents the fact that the physical being is burdened with the other purchases. The ox is commanded by the lion. That is to say that the person who is quiet and passive is ordered by the courageous giver of orders. Both of them are subject to cosmic logic. So the eagle is above here and is looking over the lion and over the ox and over the man. And the man is the central intersection of the three circles, and therefore has something of the eagle in him, that is the intellect, something of courage and the capacity to order things about, and something of burden-bearing, responsibility. A sense of responsibility is inherent in existing at all. I'm going to draw, I'll take that away, will you remember that please? I'll take this workable pen, I hope. I'm going to draw a little glyph, which you all know, called a thrice twisted cord. And that is a letter H. It's a higher spirit, and it refers to a human being as a hierarchical structure in which a life force has travelled, crossed itself, gone up, and come down. So, the bottom end here, we have two loose ends. Now, we can interpret this in exactly opposite ways, so I'm going to draw the same thing like this over this side, only this time the loose ends are at the top. Now there has been a process called the fall. This has reduced the human being from a level of cosmic wisdom, understanding, down to a level of mechanical calculation and empirical dependence on material information. The fallen man is here, and the loose ends are the sexual elements in the man and the woman. Those loose ends represent there, in the woman, the ova, the eggs of which she bears children. In the man, they represent the two little heads, the testicles, in which are the sperms that create. And they are down below, they are loose-ended there, because they are seeking a relationship with another being outside. So we're going to say now, we're going to write man here, and lion here, and ox here. And this is very strange, because now the eagle is down below. So I'm going to draw a line across there, and I'm going to shade this like this. What man knows about himself is that he can mentate, that is, think with mental processes. He has a degree of courage, but the courage he has is based on a mentational calculation. He thinks through a situation, he decides the probabilities of victory, and then he makes a calculated effort based on a risk, but he is conditioned by his mentation. His courage is conditioned by his thinking, and he bears the burden imposed upon him, which is the burden of the lower tongue, which is the burden of appetite and sexuality that constitutes man as a parent, an author of a being other than himself in the time matter process. And the ego for him is hidden mysteriously in the sexual energy. think very carefully, the ego, the transcendent cosmic reason, the logos, is hidden in the unconscious of the fallen human being. And then we look again, here is the man, and here is the lion, and here is the ox, and here is the ego. And that's an unfallen one. Now remember, the ego refers to transcendent cosmic reason or logos. And the ox is the bearer of the logic of being. There is an inherent logic in existence. I'm going to abstract that and do this with it. You all know that sign. It's the sign of Taurus, the sign of the ox. It is also a form of the Hebrew letter Aleph. And Aleph means an ox. And it also means the eidetic intelligence of God. Because God himself, that is the field of power, the field of intelligence, that field bears the burden of its own creative activities. So the burden is going to be borne by God because he creates. He imposes within himself the conditions of creation. So he is an ox. We take this letter, and in English we just write it like that. Well, that's a Greek form. This is the way we write it. But it's exactly the same letter. That letter, the Alpha of the Greek, the Aleph of the Hebrew, means an ox and means God himself as bearer of the activities of creation. He is able to respond to the result of his own creative activity. Now to create is to arc. To create is to arc. Arcing means quite simply ensphering, encapsulation, self-bondage. The power of the infinite absolute, a power that is sentient and feels itself, binds itself and makes itself into an ox. It has come from the invisible infinite, it has turned round, and it has bitten its own tail, and it has imposed upon itself the conditions of existence. It has made itself vulnerable to attack. And if he makes another one in the same way, like that, the two of them can enter into contingent relation and condition each other's behavior. There is interference between existential beings. Now we're going to examine very carefully this relationship. Man on earth, the empirical scientist, the man who thinks that he has to think in order to know and needs sense data to think about, makes himself by his belief chained to the sense organs, his five special senses and some others not so special. He makes himself dependent on the external situation. He peripheralizes himself. He throws his awareness out to where he can receive the impact of a stimulus from another being. He reduces himself from a creative central being of initiative to a being enslaved by stimuli coming to him from his external turned senses. And that man counts. Now the reason he counts is this. Ma means substantial appetite, and N means the negation thereof. he has to control himself to become man. An animal naturally does not control itself. An animal goes towards pleasure and away from pain, and it doesn't make any attempt to become a yogi. Nobody's ever yet seen a kangaroo sitting down with crossed legs, with downturned eyes, looking at the tip of its nose and thinking about the origin of its tail. The man has had to control himself because uncontrolled appetite destroys itself. Uncontrolled appetite gets you into trouble. Did any of you see a film recently, an Indian film, about the marriage of Rama and Sita? No? You're probably too refined to watch Channel 4. In it, the baddie was named Ravana. Now we could translate that quite easily and legitimately into modern jargon by saying he's a raver. Ravana means a ravaging being that wants nothing except its own way immediately, regardless of the condition of the person on whom he wants his own way. It is an uncontrolled, insensitive drive to enjoy itself. It's going to come to nothing, that's the Vama part, because it is trying to rule, that's the Ra part, without any consideration whatever for the ruled. He is the villain of the piece. Now he has to be defeated by another man, an incarnation of Vishnu, who comes down, and his name means rule your mother. And there's another little reference here. Mara, your mother rules you, and that is death. And what is your mother? Your mother is not the external being in the physical world. Your mother is your appetite. Your mother is your own appetite. Remember, the baby makes its own placenta. The baby feeds by its own efforts on the being in whom it has found itself, and itself is an appetite trying to dominate the situation. Ma Ra. The control of it, Ra Ma, means you have to control your own substantial appetite in order to defeat this appetite that comes to nothing. That Vama is the same as vain in English, vanity. You come to nothing. An indiscriminate attacking, ravishing, appetival energy that has no awareness whatever of the condition of the being that it intends to ravish comes to nothing. There is an automatic close down. You've all seen enough nature films to know that the female animal finally has the power to say no to a male wooer. He can chase and he can pursue, he can jump on, but finally she decides when and where she will accept this suitor. And we'll go back to our thrice twisted string. Man is an empirical counter. He is closed at the top. He thinks there's nothing above him. He thinks that the thinker on earth is the lord of the earth. He thinks that if he becomes knowledgeable, studies science, he can control all below him. He can control the lion and the ox. Now we're going to have the lion king. and for ox, worker. This is a very simple social structure. There are kings, workers, and the man in charge. Now that is a sort of diagram of democracy, isn't it? The electorate determine whether you will or will not be allowed to remain on the throne. Now the fallen man is precisely the man that thinks there is nothing above the thinking man, and all you have to do to be in total charge of the situation is to think more clearly, to get to know more things, to become scientific, to become empirical, and to dictate to natural kings, to the lions of this world, and to tell the workers what to do. This is like a diagram of the CP in Russia. The CP is essentially an intellective, fallen, empirical man. He can depose kings, as in the 17th revolution. He can determine who is a worker and where and of what kind. And he does it by reasoning on the basis of his five senses. So he uses for his symbol a five-pointed star. The five-pointed star occurs in America, in the structure of the Pentagon, and in Russia, and on the Turkish flag. This five-pointed star means I rely on my five senses, my common sense in the middle of my five senses, and I grow in knowledge by using my senses. And this man says kings can be controlled by knowledge. And we have the right, if we have the empirical knowledge, to dictate to natural kings, natural leaders, and workers. Now that is a fallen man. Now let's have a look at the other man. The other man, the loose ends there, are really the wings of the eagle. And that signifies spirit. It signifies intelligent, eidetic initiative transcending all creatures whatever. This is a closed loop here, and this is closed, and this is closed. Those are three closures and one open-ended. The open-ended one, unfallen, is the consciousness that infinite awareness is superior to finite awareness. No matter how much information man may collect through his five senses, his information is necessarily limited. It is finite, gained through limited senses, and it cannot carry him outside the field of his information. Now, the other end is an open and infinite, supreme intellectual, intelligent power represented by the eagle. Let's write eagle in another way. You might recognize the word. God and Yea, the earth. There is heaven and earth. Those of you who have done biology will recognize the word. The very principle of life is a combination of the unlimited with the limited. As we saw here, the unlimited and the limited. In that letter, Aleph, which is Taurus. If we don't have the unlimited, we cannot be free. If we don't have the limited, we cannot exist. In order to exist, we must be bound. But if we are merely bound and not free, we are machines. So mysteriously, we have to do both. We have to have a divine the owl, and we have to have the bound incarnate consolidated being for the three to operate upon. Now, if the three has absolutely no limitations whatever, we'll write it up there for three, that represents a power with no resistance whatever. The power is sentient, but it has no resistance. Now, if it has no resistance, meets no resistance, what can it know? Can it know anything? It is not possible. A free, absolutely free, intelligent power cannot know anything. So it needs a dome being. We represent that with a square. We represent the three with a triangle. We've got an original drawing of Solomon's temple. A cube with a pyramid on it. A square with a triangle. The triangle represents fire. That's a very good drawing of ascending flames. Fire has always been the symbol of the tree, because if you get a tree, cut it down, throw it on the fire, the tree diminishes and you see flames coming out, and the flames go upwards and vanish. And when you look, you don't find any tree, it's gone. That which was a tree has vanished, it has become free. The universe is full of burned trees that we can't see. The primordial energy represented as fire in primitive mythologies, by self-condensation, by self-cooling, has become the material world. So the triangle became the square. The pyramid became the cube. We can put a couple of columns up like that. And we've done a very primitive drawing of the temple of Solomon with two columns. On one we'll put a B, and on the other we'll put a J or a Y. This means strength. That means to establish. And together, the free energy and the domed matter constitute the temple of the universe. Strength, affirmation. The affirmation of strength, positive. Now the strength is in the fire, but the fire rises and vanishes unless you fixate it and bring it down. Now the unfallen means that our guy, God, is his own substance. When we think about God the Three Spirit, we call it God the Father. When we think about the same God as substantially occupying infinite space, we call it God the Mother. It's just legitimate to have a God the Mother as a God the Father. A fight between men and women on earth has tried to establish the superiority either of woman over man or man over woman, and that is a total misconception, which strangely enough in Hindu philosophy is not present, because there they see these two presuppose each other. One is a substantial aspect of the other, and the other is the transcendent aspect of the substance, and both are aspects in the mind of man, and they are not ultimately two beings at all. If we view the matter of the universe substantially, we can represent it by M, and if we view the same matter as formulated, we can represent it by a hierarchy H, because all matter is structured. and all structures constitute material, and they are not two separate things. When the transcendent ego, which Plato would call the noumenal world, the world of abstract ideas, comes down to the first sign, it makes itself into God. So that the transcendent there, the ego, is called the Godhead, and the first turn of that makes a cosmic body, which is God as a being. And the Godhead is the power which makes itself into a three-dimensional being called the big universe, the macrocosmos. And it bears the burden of its own creative intent. And having first made its big circle, it then assumes authority over it and becomes the king. He is Kinge, king. He has locked himself in a situation where he agrees to be the lord of himself as a created sphere. God the king. That's like saying, Adonai the Lord, Melech the king. God is king, and that king then, acting for God, sends down a message to man here. Man has to obey the king, and the king is appointed by God. Now the king is only God himself in a human being who has learned how to keep, that's the K, himself in the earth situation, fully condensed, fully knowledgeable, because he has the ego, Godhead, setting up for him the symbol of God, and then he studies the cosmic law. I will say that this God here is the second God, and that's called the Son of God in Trinitarianism, God the Son. The one up there is the Father. That one is the one opposite to this one. Now when the fall occurs, the whole thing turns over and the Godhead is hidden in substance. It's hidden inside sexuality, in the human being and in the animal. You know that all evolution of human beings and animals and plants is through the seed. Just remember that. And for woman, we're going to have the glyph for substance. Closure, saita. Outside of that is free. And here's the dome. And that dome would be represented in the Hebrew terminally, final man, as a square. Initially and medially, it is open and written more like that. There's an opening there. But finally, it is a closure, and it is called the Mother of God. That's the Mary of Roman Catholicism. It is the Mother of God. It is the first closure. Mother of God does not mean prior to God in the temporal sense, like mothers are said to be prior to their children, inaccurately, because the thing that is going to become the child is already coexistent with the mother in the form of an ovum in the mother. Is the mother really prior to her child if their ovum is inside the mother? A little girl is born with an estimated 200,000 ovaries in her at birth. They are co-present with her. She's not prior to them temporarily. She is synchronous with them. She's contemporary with her own children, because they're in her body waiting to be triggered by spermatic energies from the male. They are there with her, contemporaries of their own mother. In the same way, this closed sphere gives rise to the concept of substance. Now, substance means sum, understand, standing. If I draw a little man up here, like this, he's standing on the globe, the sphere of the earth, and that on which he stands, he says, is under him, and all that big globe to him is substantia, which is substance. He feels something pressing him down, which he calls gravity, trying to force him to the center of that sphere of the earth, and that force of gravity is a grave thing, because eventually he will get tired and it will claim the body which has been pushed up from the earth to make the body of the man. When an amoeba is going about and wants a bit of food, it pushes out from itself a finger called a pseudopodium, false finger. Man on earth is a push out of the earth like that, for the time being, to gain certain experience. The earth is a great substantial being and is called the Mother of God. And it is simply God viewed as substance standing underneath the observing man. The Father is the one that put the Mother there. That is to say, the infinite intelligent power positing itself by the process of self-encapsulation, doming, putting itself there, made itself into its own mother. So if you read carefully the theology of the origin of the Trinity and the Mother of God, you will find that the Mother of God is only God viewed substantially, and that the Mother of God is the spouse of God and the daughter of God, because actually it is all power, and the power is called the male aspect. The substantial aspect of the same is called the female aspect, and that female aspect is the mother and wife and daughter of that power. So we then have this marvelous substance here. And we say marvelous on purpose as a technical term. It is mar, that is substance, activated, differentiating itself, and in the process veiling itself from itself. It's mar veilus. When the cell divides itself like this, it veils its unity from itself. It actually thinks now it's four beings, and one of the beings is a fire being, and one is an air being, and one is a water being, and one is an earth being. That's a lion and an eagle, etc. The four beasts are there again. Now, when we see this, man and plants and animals are really outgrowths of the same power that condensed itself within the solar field and became the earth. The earth is a globe of mineral substances, fundamentally elements of the atomic scale, which are reducible right down to hydrogen, and then before that to simple wave packets of energy. And when it has cooled itself sufficiently, it pushes up as grass. You know that little saying, all flesh is grass. Grass comes, and then come the animals to eat it, and then the men to rule it. Everything is a child of the earth. But the earth itself is the daughter, the child, and the wife and the mother of the Spirit, and they are in no way separate from each other in their function. Substance is power. There's a spot there in the middle, I'll leave it there. I'll put that in the position of the eye of Shiva. Now let's examine very carefully. We live inside an infinite field of sentient power. We are modalities of that power, and that power, because it contains all and is sentient, knows all, and therefore it symbolizes the ego. Because the ego, by flying very high, can look down and see all things. So all knowledge, total knowledge, wisdom, is symbolized by the ego. So we could say that Sophia and the ego and the Logos and the Son of God are synonyms. And that ego, in this top part here, is transcendent of the lion and the ox and the man. And this part of it here, like a fan, is pure ego. That is to say, the noumenal world, the eidetic field, the hexalic field, in its purity, is represented as the ego. And the very same field, a spatial occupier offering resistances, is the ox. It is bearing the burden of itself. There is an inertia of idea, cosmic idea. Now remember, the word inertia means in work affirming. In at work, ya affirming. Affirming work within is the meaning of inertia. Inertia is not a bad word. Inertia is the guarantee of the persistence of being. The fact that the noumenal world persists means there is an eidetic inertia, whereby ideas remain eternally what they are. A triangle is a triangle, a square is a square, forever and ever, amen. Now the ego therefore transcends absolutely. Now when we are analysing a diagram of this kind, which is a kind of Venn diagram, we need to keep them separate in order to consider the relations in their fields of overlapping. The eagle I'm representing with blue there, the heavenly colour, the celestial colour, blue is the colour of thought. And the thought here is not empirical, not derived from the five senses. It precedes those senses and itself is the author of the existence of the senses. So it is blue. It is the colour of heaven. It is the celestial realm. The ego is a celestial being. Now, as to its occupancy of space, the ego itself, with its inertia, is the ox. The ox is another aspect. The bearer of the burden of the logic of the ego. The ego, as bearing its burden of its own logic, is the ox. Here is the ox, and it is passive. It's got its head down, but it's not saying anything except perhaps an occasional move, like its wife taught it. The ox also has its aspect entirely in itself, the idea of substance bearing the impressions imposed upon it. Like clay, if you get some clay and press your thumb into it and then look in the clay, you will see the print of your thumb in the clay. That is the torus aspect, the ox aspect, has received the impression of the thumb and it has agreed to receive it. so that the ox is the acceptance of the ego imposition of cosmic truth upon itself. He could kick against it, but he doesn't. In its unfallen state, it accepts the logic of the fact that creation implies an imposition and an acceptance of the imposition. Imposition means putting in, posing in. Imposing is imposing. You imposit, and you accept that which you imposit. If you give yourself an idea of a job to be done, and then you obey the idea and do the job, you are playing the ox to the ego idea that you had. Now on the side of the lion here, it has the energy which carries the ego idea into the Taurus ox substance. The lion presses in. The lion is the energy that gives the orders to the recipient substance. The lion is your courage that makes you impose on you. And while you're doing this, the lion is itself, pure courage and will, and yet overlaps here with the ox. It overlaps here with the eagle, and the eagle overlaps with the ox, and the three of them overlap in man. Now, let's consider very carefully. Man has intellect, pure logic, eidetics, hexonics, numinality, pure philosophy, cosmic knowledge inside himself before he falls into identification with the external world. But man also has an aspect belonging to the ox. He has a physical body, and that body is impressed by the idea that he has from the ego and the energy he has from the lion. And likewise, that man has the courage to apply the idea. Why should we need courage to apply an idea? The answer is very simple. Existentially, if you get a new idea and then voice the new idea, you will generate opposition to the idea. You will need courage. If you get a new truth and present it to someone who hasn't heard it before, that person's inertia, their previous view, previous belief, previous conviction, will react against the new truth, and there will be a fight. And if you haven't got the courage to impose, that is, put in the idea into the resistant substance of the inert mind of the other being, then it will never be put in. There will be no evolution. But if you have that courage, and you know the eagle in you, in this overlapping zone, here is where the eagle talks to the lion. The eagle says to the lion, have courage, this is an eternal truth. And the eagle talks to the bull here and says, accept it, there is no escape from cosmic logic. And the lion here says to the ox, you must accept my will, otherwise you cannot embody the idea, because in yourself you are passive and you can't do anything about it, and the ego is abstract, he's way up the mountain looking down. He's not involved in the level of the ox in the field. So the lion and the bull have a conversation. The lion says to the ox, accept, and the ox, unfallen, says, I accept. The ox cannot get at that intellectual stuff by the own effort of the ox, because the ox has given itself to passive acceptance. So the lion has to mediate the ego to the ox. Now the man has a special job to do. He has to listen to the ego's pure cosmic logic. He has to have the courage of the lion, and he has to have the acceptance capacity of the ox in order to constitute himself as a threefold being. And yet, this man is called a beast. In Ezekiel and in the Revelation, he's one of the four beasts. Why is he a beast? Answer, because he is B-S-S-T. He is self-crucified. He's a beast because he has accepted the position of coordinator of eagle, lion, and ox. And he has a special weapon. The weapon is the sword coming out of the mouth, whereby he defines the function of the eagle, the function of the lion, the function of the ox. It is the job of a fallen man to coordinate the intellectual ego, cosmic, unfallen truth, the courage without any possibility of cowardice in the lion daring to speak this truth, the acceptance of the truth, and the outspeaking of these three through man. Now those four beasts are beasts because they're encapsulated. The whole thing is an encapsulation device. There can be no creation without encapsulation. Encapsulation is another word for ensmearing, for rolling up into a ball. Without that roll-up of energy, there would be no universe. Without the acceptance of the limitations that we have, we would not exist. Without the cosmic logic, the eternal truth to which we can refer, our existence would be mechanical and meaningless. And without the courage to apply it, our life would be entirely useless and one of fear. So the four beasts are said to be before the throne of God. The throne of God is the throne of God. I'm going to do a throne now. Throne is spelled two ways, the verb to throw and the verb to throne, as creation of unity. From the infinite, the energy throws itself like that. It throws itself. That's funny. You can't be surprised at that one. It's torn the map of reality. So we will carry on with terrible persistence. We'll find a place somewhere and we'll utilize. Every universe is created out of the debris of prior universes. It is thrown and it falls into stone and does that until it meets itself. Now that is a throne. That word, THR, is just a version of Torah, the law, rota, the spin, plus own. Because it is own by the infinite, and the thing that is owed is this being, this sphere. And the same thing is a Torah, law, one, unity. So it is a throne. And the one who throws consciously, the intellect, ego, the courage lion, and the acceptance ox of himself, creates for himself in that very act of that threefold acceptance of the necessities of being, creates for himself a throne. And he is then sitting on the throne, and his name is Kay. His name is unlocked in gross material body by my own intent to be. As the Muslims would say, he says, be, and it is. Now we have within ourselves the simplicity of eagle, lion, ox. They are not usually conscious of them. Somewhere way back there, there's a diagram with a retrace. This one, we're going to remind ourselves what schizophrenia is. Schizophrenia means we make a cut, a cut, a cut. The man part can talk as if he knew what he was talking about. The way to do it, for those who are interested, is quite simple. You go out and you buy a book, and you read the book, and you commit to memory all the words from the book. You might get a book called The Hidden Teaching Beyond Yoga. I'm quoting the title of an actually published book, The Hidden Teaching Beyond Yoga. Now, yoga, of course, is the means whereby you yoke or conjoin yourself with the Absolute. But beyond even that, there is a book written. Now, people can actually create a title like Hidden Teaching Beyond Yoga, and people can look and say, my God, I'd like that. They can buy it, they can take it home, they can put it by the bed, they can promise to read it, they can look at the title, they can say, tonight I'm tired, tomorrow I will read it. And it can be there. Finally, when they die and the wife sells it to the song, somebody else will do the same thing with it. It is talking as if one had existential knowledge. Now that's schizophrenia. That is splitting yourself. You're cutting your mind away. It's like reading all the books on Zen immediacy and then going out with a fully equipped Zen vocabulary. But without the courage, without the lion, that man is nothing but a verbalizer of remembered things. And he is schizophrenic. He's split in his comprehension of himself. And exactly the same way as the man who cut himself off and read all the best books and have all the best ideas. But it is possible by doing a certain exercise in yoga to become as light as a cloud. And to float, to levitate. And one can think, if I were to breathe in a certain way, a certain number of times, I would float. One can actually believe, maybe when I've got time, I'm not too busy, I will float. One can think like this. And not have the courage to try to do it. Not have the courage to say, okay, I'll float. So I don't need the support of the roof of the house I'm standing on. I walk off the edge of the house and trust myself to my yogic insight. I knew a man that did that one. He only felt three floors. Now the lion, the courage, can likewise be cut off from the ox. He has the courage, tremendous courage, to do things. But he doesn't accept the consequences of what he does. What does he feel like to have tremendous courage? You know, all you need is courage. You can look at something and say, that's very nice, I'll have that. I'll courageously seize it. And then somebody hits you on the nose, and the pain in the nose and the smell of the blood becomes an object of meditation, and the courage fades. That's another schizophrenia. And in the same way, the ox can accept that there are processes organic in it and go out and do what is called enjoying itself. They can go to a surgeon and the surgeon will say, I'll just make a little incision there so that those don't work. And you can enjoy yourself with no consequences. There are actually consequences, one of which is quite amusing, because if you make that little cut, the body generates antibodies that kill sperm, which had to be learned experimentally. So here we have cats. Now, when we cut in this way, the ego is hidden in the substance of being, in the so-called unconscious mind. That which is supreme consciousness in the unformed man, the unfettered ego, cosmic awareness, that has now hidden itself in the ground. That's the blood of Abel, murdered by Cain, the knowing fellow, crying for vengeance. He wants man turned up again. He wants to say that man is not closed at the top, but closed at the bottom. And he has to wind his way back upwards. To get back upwards, he must have the courage to make the effort to accept the will of the Absolute. Why do people have difficulty in accepting the will of the Absolute? Answer, they don't know what it's going to require. Very strange that. I believe in God. I believe in His Absolute Wisdom. I believe He knows what He's doing, and He knows what's good for me. And I'm a bit nervous. How do I know that what's good for me is going to be nice for me? And this is the way the man inverts and becomes fallen. He doesn't trust the Absolute Intelligence. And these four beasts before the throne of God are there in eternity. They're before the throne, they are inherences of the infinite sentient power before creation begins. They're hidden. Imagine we live on Earth in a certain orbital distance from the sun, within the solar system, in a sidereal system, a vast system. We are inside it. We are modalities of it. We cannot get away from it. We've got no more authority or freedom than a wave has on the sea from the sea. And we have to learn to like it. We have to accept, and we have to say, we need the courage to accept the man at the bottom as the lion above him, and above him the ox. And the lion king has to accept that there is cosmic logic. Sometimes we get powerful lady prime ministers who have no regard for anything except the feminine will to do it. Quite sure that the Absolute can't disagree. And somewhat surprised if eggs are thrown. Now inside our own economy we have a little state, like the bigger political state, and we have the same problem that the state has in the same period. In every century there is a problem inside the individual and outside. The problem outside is pretty obvious. A disintegrating world, unemployment, starvation, destruction, approaching war to devastate everything. The same thing is inside every individual. We've got millions of unemployed impulses in us. We have a party disintegrating. We have parties fighting each other within the individual organism, in exactly the same way as in the political larger organism. And our only way of dealing with it individually within us is by this process of looking at the four beasts and observing their position. They make in the zodiac what is called the fixed cross, which you have Taurus opposed to Scorpio. Now Scorpio is a water sign, but as we said, when you heat the water, it turns into an air. Scorpio means devotion to the work chosen. And when you devote yourself with strong feeling, which is the meaning of Scorpio, with attachment, devotion, you learn the structure of the thing you examine. Like I was saying earlier to a woman friend of mine who wants to draw human figures, it's a good idea to know a bit of anatomy if you want to draw the human figure. If you're really interested, you will actually study it. And from your interest, which is an emotive state, you will discover an intellectual structure. You'll actually like the very logical, geometrical, mathematical principles of skeletal structures in the body and the disposition of muscles on those bones. And the whole organism will grow logically, geometrically, mathematically, out of your emotive interest. And then you have what Spinoza would call the intellectual love of God. Because you cannot do a proper job in any field without an absolute formal knowledge, and you can't get that formal knowledge, the ego, without having the acceptance and the courage to submit to it. And most people don't want to know about cosmic truth because it might impede them. There's an awful lot of people in the world that are said to be mentally ill. But if you get near to their problem, they don't want to lose it, because they're afraid that if they were to become purely rational in the cosmic sense, they would have to give something up that they don't want to give up. And when you look at the sign Scorpio opposite to Taurus, Taurus means the passive acceptance of the devotion of yourself to the pursuit of some goal. And when you, in Scorpio, a water sign, takes, devote yourself, the devotion undoes the hidden secret form, and the Scorpio converts into the eagle. That is to say, your supreme intellectual insight grows out of your emotional interest. And then the ox, that's you, the burden bearer, accept the consequences of your own devotion. Now, opposite to the line between Scorpio and Taurus, there's a line that goes from Leo to Aquarius. Now, observe on the fixed sign we have Taurus, the bull, Leo, a lion, Scorpio, transcendent Aquila, an eagle, three obvious animals. And opposite the middle one, the lion, a man. Aquarius has a man's face. Aquarius is the beast with the face of a man. And remember, the word beast means B-A-S-T. Be a self-crucified being. That means instead of waiting for somebody else to crucify you, you do it. You impose on you the truth that you can grasp. And in the self-crucified position, there is no disagreement. You're a slave to yourself, your real self, not a reactive, fallen self, but a true, transcendent self. Now, the position of Leo is a position of will and courage, energy, and the position of Aquarius is the exact opposite. It is not will, it is contemplation of the pure logic of truth. It is the man looking at the transcendent field, which is the ego translated into the eidetic world, the noumenal world of Plato. There you have man himself, the only being on earth who is a beast and yet able, by turning his head upwards from the earth, to contemplate the stars, to discover in the rotation of the stars the measurement of all things in a colossal wheel of being. It's through contemplation of the stars that the shepherd kings of the ancient world learned how to measure the year, how to subdivide it, how to invent 360 degrees to a circle, how to invent geometry and mathematics, the lever, and using the fire of Leo well, and the lever to make all the inventions that today we receive the benefit of. So the man is a very peculiar triplicity. He is simultaneously an eagle, lion, ox. Now, to become consciously aware of this fact and to say that everything that has happened so far has been willed by the essential man for his own development. The thing you call bad, a misfortune, is a good. If you meditate on it, you will find that the behavior that you had before, the thoughts you had before, was inviting this apparent misfortune to bring you to reconsider your position and to invert the fall. So when we look at the four beasts, we see relations. We can see a man in the middle. You know the green man? That's the green man. Now the green man is man before civilization traps him. The green man is the spontaneous man. If you look in your mythologies of all religions, you will find the green man was murdered by the city-building man. We get the first record of it in the Old Testament. Cain, builder of the first city, an agriculturist, murders Abel, a herder. Gilgamesh of the Babylonians is responsible for the death of Enkidu. Romulus, the city builder, murders Remus. Everywhere we find Set murdering Osiris. Everywhere civilization kills the green man. And the green man is able. The green man is calling from the ground of his being for justice. He wants to say, somewhere it should be possible for a city to have spaces, open spaces, with animals in those spaces in good conditions, not the horrible condition of cheap zoos like they used to have when I was a boy. The zoos were a disgusting sight. Today they have an approximation in some zoos towards natural conditions. Their ideal state is a state in which a free man can walk about amongst free animals, and the lion and the lamb lie down together. Now this cannot come into being unless inside every individual the civilized man makes room for the green man, the uncivilized man in himself. We know that the early church of a couple of thousand years ago nearly was very, very terrified of the green man, what he called the pagan, who had certain natural religions that did not involve self-control. And so he clamped down very, very heavily on the natural man, the pagan, the green man. And he clapped all he could down upon him, irons, chains, books of restraints, and he crippled the spontaneity of man and reduced man to a ritual being at the mercy of bad advice, and created that terrible thing, the unconscious mind. Now before the suppressive activities of those early religious leaders, who were terrified that man would backslide into the animal condition that he had left, and that was a real fear, that man would not evolve and regain his unfallen state, that he would live with the beast as a beast and would never assume his true authority. Afraid of that possibility, they clamped down, they made negative statements, they condemned all spontaneity and created the unconscious mind. Now the unconscious mind as opposed to the conscious. Dionysus means a god that says no to the things he's asked to say yes to. And his opposite number is the civilizer, Apollo. Now, civilization's restraints, unintelligently followed, produce the unconscious mind, and in the unconscious mind is not an accepting Taurus, an ox accepting, but an ox revolting, an ox banging its head against the stalls, trying to get out, and a lion breaking the rules, and an eagle fled away from this ridiculous situation. What is called the curse in the Bible is simply that the ego, Sophia, wisdom, disgusted with the behavior of man, who turned his courage into violence to suppress the ox, fled away from the scene, so that man was bereft of cosmic intelligence, lost his intuition and his spontaneity, became condemned as dangerous to the state. Now we have to regain the condition where our spontaneity is intelligently permeated with the wisdom gained by that transcendent power of the ego. We can only do this by undoing the hidden content of the unconscious mind. There was no unconscious mind until suppressive activities created it. The way it was created was quite simple. All you had to do, if somebody did something you didn't approve of, and you were a leader of those primitive churches, you had them put to death or thrown out of society. If it was a sexual sin, you simply removed the genital offending organ. If they thieved, you cut their hands off. You've seen a return of that in Iran in the last few years, cutting pieces off of sin. And that's an attempt to intimidate, but it merely makes an unconscious mind. The desire is not removed. The lion becomes anger and resentment in the unconscious mind and flashes out in rages at every opportunity that he can find. Now, the unconscious mind has to be made conscious again to turn the fallen man over and put him where he ought to be, where he was originally designed to be. That is to say, he will not be afraid of cosmic, logic, intelligent power. He will know its willing is good, and that his ultimate good he will affirm to be good, and he will not be afraid of it. He will have the courage to submit himself, his own ox characteristics, to the ego insights, the information. And when a man does that, in that triplicity of functions, he will have no problem. But meanwhile, we're not, in the millions of earth inhabitants, at that level where we can happily receive this kind of information. If we go out to the various organizations, we can get into trouble by telling them that we believe that a spontaneous living is a possibility that can be actualized, and it cuts through all the barriers of all negative definitional systems. Then the defenders of the definitional systems will put you to death. Or if they can't do that openly, they'll put your business to death, and your reputation to death, and everything else about you to death. If they could, they would simply hang you or shoot you. If they can't, they will destroy your business or your reputation or your possibility of relating to other people, because they are not yet ready for it. Millions of people, you've seen them fighting about religions. All religions believe in God. All religions fundamentally say we should all be harmoniously related to each other. And yet, we can find, say in Assam, people being killed because it come over the border. You find people from Bangladesh walking over a little bit of an imaginary line and being killed for doing so. We saw great slaughter when India was petitioned. We've seen it in Beirut. We've seen apologies, Christians killed Muslims. And a debate whether or not Jews allowed them to do it, instead of stopping them. But attempting to stop them would create another war. Now we have to be very careful that we do not expose prematurely the idea, the true idea, of the four beasts, which are symbols of our functions, to people who are unprepared for them, because if we do, we will frighten those people, and they will react against us, and they will try to destroy the view that is being expressed. So there is fundamentally imposed the necessity for silence to unprepared people, of which there are millions, about the simple idea that human beings could actually live spontaneously without the barriers that exist, that have been created by diversifying religious sects, all in the name of one God, which is not a sect. How do we feel about that fact? Have you not noticed that people can get annoyed with you if you tell them the truth they've not heard before? Have you noticed? Have you been so misguided as to try to enlighten somebody who doesn't want enlightenment? Have you suffered reputation loss? Even business loss? Even money can be lost. That commodity of commodities. Simply by uttering an elementary cosmic truth, that all the divisions that have divided humanity into nations, into sects, into groups, are false divisions. If you want to be killed very quickly, just go to Ulster and say that in a loud voice. I will not expect a postcard from you. Go to Ulster and say that in a loud voice.